If you are in need of some additional storage for your computer, Amazon, as of this morning, would be willing to sell you a 4 terabyte external hard drive for $149.99. Now, some of you might be wondering just what a terabyte is. Well, it is, of course, about 1,024 gigabytes. For those of you who do not think in terms of bits and bytes and zeros and ones and electrons flying around devices, a gigabyte is a rough equivalent of about 334 books. So a terabyte would be about 342,000 books. So that external storage device you could buy for $149.99 could hold about, in theory, 1,368,000 books. To put that in perspective for you, there are about 22,766,000 books in the Library of Congress, which means that all of those volumes could be put in about 17 devices that are smaller, each one, than your standard box of Cheerios. You could go into my study, about 2 shelves. That's it. All those books in 2 shelves. It's my wife's dream come true. It all sounds wonderful, indeed magical. But of course, we know technology always has its shortcomings and its flaws. Storage media become outdated. I'm sure many of you in this room have 3.5-inch disks or maybe the old 5.25 floppies. And we read stories of how the government has old computerized files on tapes, and there's no equipment available to read them. But then there's the internet, all the world's knowledge, some of it even accurate, at our fingertips. But who here hasn't experienced a power outage or a computer crash at some point in time? Sometimes, and this must be evidence that I really am going to turn 50 next year, the old ways are the best ways. That was symbolized at an exhibit I saw at the New York Public Library a couple of years ago, commemorating its centennial. And there in one of the displays, which was labeled "From Ancient Records to Breaking News," was a beautiful, sleek, white MacBook, and next to it, 2 cylinders, one squat, one tall, from Mesopotamia. The Apple computer was brand new, made in 2011. Those cylinders were dated to sometime between the 2nd and 3rd millennium BC. Thousands and thousands of years old. If I could read cuneiform script, all the information on those cylinders was available to me right there. And what about the computer? Well, the webpage was set to the New York Times, but the message on the screen announced, "Server not found, problem loading page." Think about that. The information from 4,000 years ago was more accessible to me than the information from that day, August 26th. Pretty remarkable. Now, I've had a deep interest in the history of the Near East for a long time, and I've been particularly fascinated by the cylinders and the seals that were used to record information from kings and bureaucrats. And the number of these objects that have survived throughout the ages is stunning. You could find them in museums around the world. Indeed, we have some of these at the Congregational Library in Boston, right in the display case, sitting next to some Bibles and some prayer books, are these little cylinders, about 2,500 years old. You might be wondering, how did these things wind up in a display case at a Congregational Library in Boston, Massachusetts? Well, back in the 19th century, archaeologists were digging in the Holy Land in Mesopotamia to find evidence and objects related to the stories of the Bible. Heard about historical criticism and scientific method often being used to take apart the Bible. But it's also been used to bring it alive, to flesh it out, to find evidence of these stories that have been read and passed down and shared throughout the generations. And among the archaeologists were ministers. One of them had gone over there and had found these things and brought them back, and now you can go see them at 14 Beacon Street. No admission fee required. Which brings us to the Cyrus Cylinder, a picture of which is in your bulletin. This object, which is about the size of a football, actually a little bit smaller, it was one of the great blockbuster finds in the history of archaeology. It has been described as containing the history of the ancient Near East, all in one place. It's definitely big news. I'm going to guess that nobody here actually reads cuneiform. But, fortunately, I have a translation for you, and I'm not going to read the entire inscription to you, but I will tell you, in summary, what it says. It's a proclamation, an announcement from Cyrus, that he, with the help of Marduk, the god of Babylon, has come from Persia, and has defeated Nabonidus, the ruler of the Babylonians. And he has come to bring peace to an oppressed people. That he has been commanded and empowered to restore the gods to the temples and to offer up gifts. Does any of this sound a little familiar to you? It should. The Cyrus Cylinder dates to 539 BC. In 538, the Jews in exile in Babylon were given permission to go home. And the proclamation that Brian read to us is an echo of this announcement. What's so exciting? What was so exciting for me when I saw the Cyrus Cylinder in New York this past summer was just a few inches in front of me was an object directly related to the biblical story. And it was from that time. The Cyrus of the Cyrus Cylinder is the Cyrus of today's lesson. Our our story, our scriptures unfolding in real time. Our God is a God of history and in history. That was reflected in a lesson from Luke 2. Now, the stories in Scripture don't always get the facts right. But before we start picking on Ezra, we should remember that Herodotus, the father of history, hadn't even started his work yet. And the Bible wasn't written to be history as we understand it. It's a testament to faith, a witness to God's work in the world. And the story we heard this morning was a theological assertion. See, if you look at the Cyrus cylinder carefully, Cyrus tells us a little bit about himself. On line 20, he declares, "I am Cyrus, king of the universe, the great king, the powerful king, king of Babylon, king of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four quarters of the world." Not shabby. Now, given that he had succeeded in building the largest empire in the history of the world to date, that kind of braggadocio wasn't completely out of place. But it also tells us something. Despite his nod to Marduk, the Babylonian god, it seems like Cyrus thinks that he's the one pulling all the strings, that he's in charge. King of the universe. Our Hebrew Bible tells us otherwise. In these first verses of Ezra, we hear that Cyrus delivers a proclamation giving people permission to return to Judah in fulfillment of a prophecy in Jeremiah. Cyrus is doing God's work. This is a stunning assertion. Now, don't misunderstand me. In other places in the Bible, prophets assert that kings and nations and armies are doing the will of the Lord. You can look at Isaiah, you can look at Hosea, you can look at Micah and Amos. It's all there, Jeremiah. But they're always talking about how these actors are being used to deliver judgment and punishment. They're often interpreting events. They're trying to figure out, how is it that Israel was defeated? The Davidic line brought to an end, the temple laid waste, the people sent into exile. God, they thought, was punishing them. Now, over the course of a few decades, the people in exile grappled with what this might have meant. Was it possible that the gods of other peoples were stronger than Yahweh? That they had been able to triumph over him? What a horrible thought. Even worse was that God had decided to end his covenant. The house of David was supposed to live forever. Cut off. The land had been given to them in perpetuity. You're gone. The temple. The focus of worship. A rubble heap. But over time, another possibility emerged. And that was that despite everything that had happened, God was still faithful and present. A people in exile longed to return home. They desired restoration. And it began to dawn on them that maybe things would look different in the future. you can never go back. The past is the past. Even if you had a time machine, you'd still take all of your memories and experiences. But as this new story began to be told, as the restoration looked to be unfolding with Cyrus's action, and in the decades and centuries that followed, and things were tough, and there were setbacks, and there was opposition, people realized that God was still with them, still walking with his community. Maybe things would take on a new form. But the community endured. Ezra and Nehemiah, the books, are a bit of a mess. As we do textual analysis on them, we see that things have been scrambled and moved around. But there's a dynamic that runs throughout it. God working through kings restores. And then there's opposition, but the opposition is overcome. And then there's celebration. The way these books are assembled is to make a theological point, not a historical one. And so the first thing we see being restored here is the temple. God is in his house, back in the land. Then the community of the law can be restored, and then the walls of Jerusalem. These verses that begin the book of Ezra were probably the last part of these two books that were written. They're done in retrospect. And they're meant to be a commentary on what has happened in the past. This is an assertion of hope and confidence. Even though the Davidic line was never restored to the throne, even though the people of Israel lived in a province of the Persian Empire and then the Seleucid Empire, they had their community. And God was with them. You might be wondering, what happened to Cyrus, king of the universe, the great king, the powerful king, king of Babylon, king of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four quarters of the world? He died in battle. He wanted more. Goodbye, Cyrus. And his successors. Well, they did increase the size of the Persian Empire. But after a couple of hundred years, they were defeated. What about Augustus? Golden age of Rome. Brought peace to an empire riven by strife and civil conflict. Probably poisoned by his wife. Goodbye, Augustus. Goodbye, Roman Empire. The one thing that endures is the true king of the universe. The God who established a covenant with the faithful. A covenant that takes on different forms. But God never, ever, ever breaks his promises. Once God says, I choose you, you're chosen. For good or ill. Doesn't make us special. But it means God has expressed confidence and hope. That no matter what happens, through good times or bad, through the rise and fall of empires, God is always steadfast and with his people. That is the message of restoration. That is the message for people in exile. You are never, ever alone. We can remember that when our computers crash, our government grinds to a halt, whenever anything untoward happens, God is alone.